The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Welcome to the Free Library for an evening with Mary Roach. I'm Catherine Price. I'm here to introduce her. I'm assuming that all of you know Mary's work, otherwise you would not be here, so I don't need to go through a long list of her accolades and previous books. And the many times she's been called America's funniest science writer, which I think is probably pretty accurate. So instead, I just wanted to say a couple things from a personal perspective. I had the privilege of meeting Mary about 10 years ago. I'm a journalist as well, and we were sharing an office space in California. And I was actually kind of anxious when I first met her, because as I'm sure many of you have experienced yourselves, when you're a fan of someone's and you're going to meet them in person finally, you think, oh my goodness, what if Mary Roach is not as great in person as she seems she is in her books? You know, what if she's not as funny? Like, what if we go out to lunch and, like, diarrhea does not come up as a subject of conversation at all? So I'm happy to say she's just as great in person as she is on the page. It's my real pleasure to welcome her to the stage along with Jason Freeman, who is in the author events office here at the library, who himself has a degree in creative writing and film theory and is going to be joining her in conversation. So I ask that you turn off your cell phones and join me in what I know will be a wonderful evening. So thank you.
Right, welcome everybody. So if you've picked up this book, as I have, you no doubt have 1,000 questions, and we've passed out some note cards and you've written those down. I'm going to ask mine for a little bit and then we're going to get to yours. The book, as you probably know, is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And Mary, you write that what drew you to military science, it was the quiet, esoteric battles with less considered adversaries, and the parts that no one makes movies about. Not the killing, but the keeping alive, and that's really what sets this book apart for me, and it's what I love about it. So let's just jump right into the pool here, and there is a scene in the book that I love where you are at a U.S. military base, Camp Limigné, in the Republic of Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. And it sounds like an interesting and scary place. It's the hub of counter-extremist activities in North Africa and Yemen, huge base for Navy SEALs and armed drones and all of this stuff. You're there to do a research on a particular issue, and you send out what is now known as the infamous diarrhea email. can you walk us through that, and then the special operator, Carrie, that you approach in the mess hall and set that scene?
Yeah, so I ended up in Camp Limigné because there's a researcher named Captain Mark Riddle, and his area of expertise is diarrhea. And diarrhea is of particular importance to people in special operations because they're outside the base. I mean, on the base, the food is safe and the water is safe, but once you go out into some little village in Somalia, et cetera, and you're doing your secret classified special operations thing, you're eating on the economy. You're eating goat and unfiltered water, and they get horrible diarrhea. And you can imagine if your job was to, like, go in and, I don't know, take out Osama bin Laden, let's say, and you're hit with some extreme urgency, you can't just go, can someone fill in for me? I'm feeling a little under the weather. So you just got to go through with it. And so I thought of, like, diarrhea as sort of a national security issue, and I suggested to Dr. Riddle that I come with him to Camp Limigné, where he was doing research on a treatment trial that it would be one dose and you'd be over it in a day, and which is the fact that it's a shorter treatment, hopefully less resistant strains of bacteria develop. But anyway, so we're there and Camp Limigné, which large chunks of it are off limits to me. This is where the special operations guys are in the special zone. You need clearance. I don't have clearance. They only basically come out to eat at the dining facility. So this put me in the position as a journalist of having to approach a big, scary, bearded special operations guy over his dinner and broached the topic of diarrhea.
Right. I love that. I love this public affairs officer, too, because he seems more terrified than you. And he's like, my hands are sticky from an orange. I can't go over there. Yeah, these guys are very intimidating.
They are intimidating. This guy's, he's big. He's sitting by himself. They come in, they eat, they get out of there. Seamus is the public affairs guy. Goes, they only come out. No, somebody else said they only come out to eat. And Seamus goes, and to steal our women. So I was like, Seamus, you have to come with me. You got to introduce me. This is your job. He's like, oh, I don't know, Mary. They didn't train us on this in public affairs school. I don't know. And he's peeling this orange. I'm like, come on, hurry up. He's going to leave. He's like, he's here by himself. He's not socialized. He's going to get up. This is my only chance. You know, he's like, oh, wait a minute. I got to clean my fingers from the orange. And I'm like, come on. He goes, I don't know. I've got to shake his hand. He'll kill me. Like, you got me sticky.
Okay, so you start talking to Carrie. Is that a pseudonym?
No idea. First name, last name, pseudonym. I don't know. Just said the name's Carrie.
So you start speaking to him, and walk us through that a little bit. His initial reluctance to speak to you, and then...
Yeah, so young Seamus and I cross this larger-than-this-room dining facility, kind of that nervousness of fifth graders at the dance walking across the floor going, oh, God, I don't want to do this. I so don't want to do this. And before we even get to the table, this guy, the shaved head, beard, scary guy, he's like, puts his hands on the tray, looks at us, goes, I'm done. Seamus goes, we were just thinking, could we sit down? I'm leaving. And he gets up, and Seamus is, actually says the line, what line of work are you in? Just kind of, you're obviously with the beard special operations.
Right.
So I dive in and I go, I'm an author. I'm here doing some research. It sounds kind of silly, like a silly topic. It's diarrhea. I wanted to sort of talk to you about it. I know it does seem silly. And he goes, it's not. You're welcome to sit down.
And then he tells you all about it. And it's, I bring this up first because it's very emblematic of this book, things that I think... you hear it and you're like, well, that's kind of funny. But then, you know, the people who are there, they realize how serious this kills.
Right.
You know, this is a really serious, serious thing.
Well, it
what
marks
are scientists
up a mission,
doing?
For sure. It marks up a mission. You know, he said, you know, and Seamus is like, can you walk us through it? There I was. You know, and Carrie's like, no, I'm sorry, I can't. It's classified. I can't tell you. I can't give you the there I was, you know. And he said, you know, and Seamus kept trying to like set the scene and get. And finally, he said, "Look, I've soiled my pants in Afghanistan. I've soiled my pants. I don't know what you guys want from me. That's just the reality."
Right.
Yeah. It's not only, you know. I mean, if you were in the midst of a really critical moment, and Seamus, of course, Seamus is like on the edge of his seat. He's like, wow. And so, like, then what do? Do you just go ahead with the mission? You know? And Carrie goes, it's kind of a life or death situation. So, yeah, you go ahead. Yeah.
And a lot of this is the life or death situations behind the life or death situations, too, which I find fascinating. And not just this sort of access of, you know, once you get there and you start speaking to people, just the level of access in this book, period, is really stunning. I mean, through your other books, you know, I'm kind of surprised that medical examiners and people like that will speak to you. But going through the military, going through that hierarchy, what was it like getting access, period, to a lot of this stuff?
I anticipated it being very difficult. I mean, I'd done a book, I was Packing for Mars, where I was dealing with NASA. And NASA could be sometimes just... for no particular reason, would say no. So I anticipated a lot of difficulty. The military was actually pretty open. They, you know, as one woman, one of the actually at the Pentagon, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, they will look at a book that you're, you know, very sketchy details of what you're proposing and say, yeah, this is okay. They want, I mean, it's not like a formal gold embossed letter of support. It's just an email going, this is all right by us, which is helpful. You can say I kind of have the seal of approval, though it doesn't make, nobody's required to talk to me, nobody's required to see me. It's just they, you know, they said, you know, honestly, because it took a while to get this, and I said, are you concerned? Is there something I can do to address this? And, you know, I said, yeah, here's a copy of my book, my last book, this is what I do. And they said, look, Mary Roach writing about military science is not a concern. I mean, we're concerned about Zero Dark 30. You know, right. There are certain things that are of concern to us, classified information being revealed that shouldn't. We're like, you are not, we don't care, really. You're an insignificant little piffle. Just go and do your little diarrhea thing.
Well, a lot of the book seems to rest upon this razor's edge of where the military meets the personal. And I kind of then separated those as two types of access. You know, the yeah. military giving you access to something. But again, someone like Carrie
right.
agreeing to speak to you. And you know, was it more difficult to get military access? Or was it more difficult to speak to someone who has suffered a very real, very horrible, traumatic wound,
right.
such as genital mutilation,
right.
which is
right.
something nobody seems to talk
right.
about, but is very serious?
Right, right. It was... Yeah, I mean, I remember when I talked, there was a woman at the medical school, USIS, Uniform Services University of the Health Sciences, and I said, I'd like to talk to a urological surgeon who does genital reconstruction, because this doesn't get covered very much. And I expected her to go, oh, I don't know. But she said, sure, I'll put you in touch with this guy, Jim Jezier, who does this work all the time. This is what he does. I mean, so to him, this is, it's important work. He does it all the time. He's like, sure. You can come in here. You can come into the OR with me. Yeah, that's fine. And I said, well, he goes, we got to get permission from the patient. I'm like, oh, that's going to go well. So he did. He spoke to this guy, Gavin White, who said, fine, you know, whatever. I don't know why she, whatever she wants to do, that's fine. And then, you know, he agreed to talk to me afterwards as well. And I think I was much more, I was uncomfortable, cause, not just because we're talking about his penis. I don't care. I wrote bonk. I talk to any of you about your penis. I don't care. But it was just more that, I said, tell me what happened. And it's such an, the story of, you know, stepping on the plate that sets off an IED and being blown in the air and waking up and part of both limbs and your hips, your pelvis is broken. And what is that like? I mean, that is such a terrifying and intimate thing to share with a stranger. And I just felt like, what am I doing here invading, you know? But he was never uncomfortable with it. He was
That's amazing.
Like,
yeah.
No, he said, I'm happy to talk about it. I've talked about it a lot and that's fine. I called him later to say, you know, to see how he's doing, and then I said, "So, I have your name here. Is that okay?" And he's like, "Why would I care?" I said, "Well, you're kind of the poster boy for penis reconstruction here." And he's like, "Is that no?" He doesn't. That's fine. So, just kind of remarkable the openness that people had. I didn't ever find squirreliness or shut doors. I mean, sometimes you would get, I was on a submarine, a ballistic missile submarine, and the crew was kind of yes, ma'am. Yeah, you know, yes, kind of yes or no answers. I think there was a tendency to be a little concerned about, am I going to get in trouble for talking to you?
Right.
Rather than, I'm uncomfortable talking, just like I'd rather not get in trouble. So a little bit of that.
Yeah, the doctors and patients, you know, seem to be really cheerleading this cause. The only group that seems reluctant to speak about it is the U.S. government, and it seems like that, you know, they didn't seem to value, you know, young men's reproductive lives, you know, after they return from war, right?
Yeah, in talking to, there was a surgeon at Walter Reed, he's an andrologist, so his territory is more the testicles and reproduction and fertility, and he's a surgeon, but he also ends up counseling the wounded vets a lot, and he said one of the shortcomings here is that we don't have, at Walter Reed, there's no full-time staff sex and intimacy counselor, and it's not just for someone who has genital injury. Like, say it's like if you've lost two limbs and one hand, what kind of sexual position, what how do you have a sex life? And no one wants to go near that. Everybody tiptoes around, and it makes them uncomfortable, and it's important. I mean, your personal life, your marriage is kind of blown apart, and you've got to there are things you can do. There's equipment, there's positions, there's lots of advice to be given, but no one giving it. And there are groups, there are occupational therapists, and this woman, Christine Delorier, who's doing it kind of all on her own and trying to get funding. And she said, the government, I said, is it budget? Why can't this need be addressed? And she said, well, part of it's budget, but part of it is getting the government to embrace sex as a viable thing to spend taxpayer dollars on. You know, and this guy, Dr. Dean, the andrologist, was saying, you know, that they'd be like, oh, well, it's not that important. It's important that they walk, but it's not important that they have sex. And he'd say, I beg to differ. I think it is important that they be able to have sex and have a, I mean, this is their lives and their marriage and their, that's the one area that seems sort of sorely lacking for reasons that, you know.
Thank you. Let's talk stink here for a moment.
Stink bombs. Okay.
And I know stink bomb isn't the precise nomenclature.
No.
Stink warfare, stink sprays, stink everything. The government for more than 70 years has been attempting to create awful smells as weapons of war to create, I love this, derision or contempt to humiliate the enemy. Originally during World War II. Can you talk about this a little bit more?
Sure. I found this file, or somebody helped me to find this file at the National Archives. It's the OSS, the precursor to the CIA. It's a fat file that has to do with efforts to create a really vile smell that would, and this would be in a little tube, a squirtable tube, and it would be a subtle and cheap weapon to put in the hands of resistance elements in occupied countries. In other words, like in France, if you see, like, there's a German officer and you'd see and you'd go up behind him and you'd fire this little, you'd spray this little tube of this very vile, originally fecal, but it morphed over the years into a variety, a combination of odors. And the whole thing, there were specs on it, like it had to be lastingly penetrative, it had to withstand rain and dry cleaning fluid, it had to maintain its stink for 2 hours at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. There could be no backfire. There was, however, backfire. There was a terrible, terrible problem with dribble, and people were very angry. And there was a lot of letters going back and forth about how this is unacceptable, and there's operator dribble, and there was a guy who had set up a dummy with a dress uniform and gone up and sort of pretended to be using it, you know, firing the weapon, and it got all over his hand, and he wrote this very angry letter. And anyway, many, many people involved, letters flying back and forth 2 whole years. And in the end, and then they came up with a different version for Japanese officers because it was thought that there's cultural differences in what was a foul smell. And so there was a Mach 2 Oriental version, just a crazy amount of effort that went into this little tube that was never, in fact, deployed. The final report came out, I think, 17 days before the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima.
That's an incredible paragraph in the book because it just takes it from this one place. And, oh, well, no, they just dropped an atomic bomb instead.
And weirdly, the National Defense Research Committee, the same group was involved in both. It's like, well, right. Stink bomb? Yeah.
Can you tell us the proper name of this?
It was SAC-23 was the code, but it started out, its nickname was, who, me? I know. It's who, me?
Right.
Yeah, just a kind of 12-year-old boy humor there at the OSS.
Right. Not as funny a name, but maybe more viscerally gross is stench soup. And
yes.
This being Philadelphia, I think we have to talk about the nearby, maybe there's people from this center here, the Monell Chemical Senses Center. And I was dying at one part where you're there in the book, just you smell this and...
Oh, yeah. Do we have anybody here from Monell? Oh, all right. No? Yeah?
Someone who doesn't want to raise her.
Okay. Anyway.
It's Pam.
Oh, Pam! Pam. Pam Dalton. Oh, my God. The stench soup lady. Okay. I should... Oh, my God. Oh, God. I should have her come up and tell that story. Oh, my God. But I won't put you on the spot. But she tells it better than I do. But anyway, so... in more recent times, malodorants, as they are known, have been it's a non-lethal weapon for clearing terrain. In other words, it's a smell so vile that nobody will be in the same room with it. So if you want to clear a room, disperse a mob. You know, the idea was like, this is so vile. And also the other thing it needed to be was universal. All cultures will find this vile. So Pam spent a lot of time traveling around with this. She in her luggage, like burnt hair, vomit, sewage, like bottled things that she had to carry around. At one point, she was flying to South Africa
The carry-on that
yes.
Go ahead.
Yes,
please.
So she's got all these samples in her baggage up in the overhead bin. Forgets about the change in cabin pressure, and at a certain point, stands up to go to the restroom and goes, "Oh my God, those are my smells. They're leaking." And she's telling her seatmate, "For the rest of this flight to South Africa, you cannot open the overhead bin." And I said, "Well, what did you do at the end?" And she said, "Well, this is where I was very clever, because I waited until the doors to the plane were open before I opened the overhead bin, just so that people go like, huh, I guess this is just how it smells here."
Aww. Poor South Africa, getting a bad smell rap. And to give an idea of how bad this smells, you opened it on, this is the same stuff you opened on your back porch.
Yeah. I made the mistake of having Pam bring me in her carry-on luggage. Yeah, a bunch of samples that I had my husband come out onto the back porch and smell. And really, I'm not a gagger. I'm not a person who gags easily, as you can imagine. And I gagged, and not even on the really hardcore ones. This was just butyric acid, which in the right circumstance could be like Parmesan cheese. But you take a big whiff, and you're not in a deli, and it's pretty gross. Anyway, so Pam's assignment at one point was, this was the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Directorate in the late 1990s, is like, give us a really, really foul smell that will not harm anyone, cannot be harmful, but is universally awful. And so they developed this amazing, they started out with like a universally loathed, it's called U.S. government bathroom mallow, U.S. government's standard government bathroom malodor. They started with that, because that's the one everyone hated, which was developed as a smell upon which to test deodorants for latrines. So it's a nice mimic of a really foul smell. But then what I love, the craftiness of the scent expert, is that they added this sort of floral, kind of nice-smelling top note. So you take a little whiff, because you're tentative. You're like, I don't know what that smell is. And you go, oh, that's nice. And then on the keeper inhale, you take it in, and it's this horrible stench. Horrible, just awful. And I love, we had this conversation over lunch, did we not? Yes. And the glee with which she and her coworker were describing the diabolical, fabulous craftiness of stench soup. Yeah.
Right here in Philly, everybody. So the military is known for conducting hyper-realistic military training exercises. You know, you've seen it in every movie where they're training and, you know, there's fake explosions, fake that kind of thing. I think one thing that we haven't really seen is the medical side of that.
Mm-hmm.
You describe in detail, you know, those of you who've read other books in describing these bodily, gulp, something like that. You describe adrenaline rush and how it makes you, you know, it's a great survival instinct.
Fast, strong, and dumb.
Right.
It makes you.
Which is not what you want from a combat medic.
No.
And you visit a man named Stu Sagal, who was kind of a Hollywood explosion kind of guy, and you visit his company. Can you tell us about what he does?
Sure. It's called Strategic Operations, but it's a big movie studio near San Diego, not far from Camp Pendleton. And because he used to do action films, so he's really good at explosions and violence and gore. So he repurposed all these talents to do these hyper-realistic training for combat medics and for Navy corpsmen who are doing the medical care for Marines, the Navy corpsmen. So these kids really come in and they have to do emergency medical procedures in these scenarios And hyper-realistic means, first of all, there's gunfire. There's pyrotechnics guy who's doing gunfire. They've got dust hits, so it looks like rifle fire. You know, rifles, bullets are hitting the ground. They're playing over loudspeakers. Something I thought it was an actual recording of Vietnam or something. It was the soundtrack to Saving Private Ryan. But it's pretty intense. And then they've got actors, amputee actors. Two of them were amputees, and on the stump, they had a latex sleeve with very realistic gore and a backpack that has got a blood supply, stage blood, and a pump, and it's pumping, and it's bleeding, like there's a pool of blood. And the guy is screaming, the actor, and this corpsman trainee comes into the room, and he has to put on a tourniquet, and he has to do it right. And if he doesn't do it right, the amputee has the remote control to shut off the bleeding or to bleed himself out and die. So it's really, it is intense. I mean, I was there just observing. I was playing a reporter who gets in the way. I was typecast. So, but it was, but, you know, I knew that, and they, on a certain level, all knew they didn't really cut off this guy's leg to train us. So he had to know on a certain level. But it was very intense, and the loud noises, it's very, you have this startle response, and your adrenaline gets going. And so the idea is something, the concept is stress inoculation. Like if you give someone a lesser dose of what they're going to experience in the reality of combat, hopefully that will kind of inoculate them a little bit. They'll be better able to cope when the real deal unfolds. So that's the hope anyway.
Yeah, and these actors, see, and you must call them actors because they put Marlon Brando to shame with their method. They just reading the book, you can tell how serious they are about it.
Yeah,
And there's even the acknowledgement still that we can simulate this, we can do this, but ultimately, there's nothing like the real thing, right?
Well, right, because you can't, no one's shooting at you, you know. So, there was one paper where the guy was sort of, he sounded a little bit mournful, like, you know, of course, it's too dangerous. We can't really be shooting. You know, it's like, it's probably a good thing that you're not firing weapons over these people's heads. But anyway, that is, it's one element of their training. There are other, that sometimes they'll send them to like a South Central or other, you know, tough part of LA emergency room, and they're observing or taking part and dealing with, you know, scary emergency scenarios. Yeah.
Right. You have these lovely segues between chapters in the book. Mine aren't that lovely, so let's talk about maggots. And flies. And historically, I think we all have an image of the fly, of the maggot, as a disease spreader. And while this may be true, this book is a love letter to people who operate outside of preconceived notions about, you know, what to do. Can you tell us what military medicine in particular is doing with the common, or maybe actually they're very special maggots, what they're doing with maggots today?
Well, the chapter is called Flies on the Battlefield for Better and Worse. And flies, you really don't want, because historically, battlefields were just a cornucopia for a filth fly, the average fly, the kind that you are swatting all the time that you don't want, because there were decomposing bodies, there was a lot of garbage and kitchen scraps, and there were open pit latrines. So the flies would land on the crap, and then they would go to the mess halls were just open, they weren't screened, and they would land, and the fly is what's called a mechanical vector. It picks up pathogens from the crap, and then it lands on the food, and it delivers it, and then it sits in the sun, because there wasn't refrigeration in like a Civil War field camp, then the bacteria multiply exponentially, and then you've got a lot of guys really sick throwing up and creating more material for the flies to then go and spread. And so there's a quote by William Osler, prominent physician in the 1890s, said, "Dysentery has been more fatal to soldiers than powder or shot." And it was really true. The ratio 7-1 in the Mexican-American War, incidence of disease versus, you know, injuries and death from disease versus combat injury, 7-1. A lot of it dysentery and diarrhea, some of it malaria, but yeah.
Well, Can you tell us
maggots.
The upside?
Yeah, the upside. Yeah, sorry, yes.
No, this is all great. Well, that's what I love, is that a lot of these things, these horrible and great things, exist on opposite sides of the same coin. You know?
Right, right. So the flies, yeah, this is why today there are military entomologists. It's an actual discipline. But in World War II, there were fly control units, there were sanitation officers, and there were even death quotas where everyone in the camp, this was in North Africa and during World War II, they had every man had to kill 50 flies a day. It's like that was their part of their quota, and you'd see posters of a big fly with a bayonet stuck in it, like, this is the enemy. They're like going around with fly swatters, and but before they become flies, they're maggots, and maggots, interestingly, are kind of an amazing medical tool. They are, in fact, FDA approved medical device. The maggot in a wound, and this dates the first systematic study of using maggots. Came out of World War I. There was a doctor who saw a couple of guys came in with big wounds, had been lying out in the brush. The wounds were infected with a lot of maggots. Everyone was like, "Oh, you could get them out." They took them out, and Dr. Baer noticed that these underneath where the maggots had been, it was this very healthy pink new tissue. So the maggots were performing debridement, which is important to foster healing. You need to, it's usually done surgically. You remove the dead tissue to promote the healing and the new and the growth of new tissue. But he noticed the maggots seemed to be eating only the dead tissue. So they're doing this natural debridement, and there was no infection. So they seem to be producing having some kind of antibiotic effect. And he studied it in like 69 patients, and all of these very stubborn wounds that weren't healing were now healing. And so this is done even today. It's not big in the military. It's not used as much. It's more in diabetic patients who have foot ulcers that won't heal.
Right.
And there's a company called Medical Maggots, TM. And there's a Medicare reimbursement code for maggots.
There you go.
And there's a dosage, and they come in a little, looks like a prescription bottle. There's your maggots. And there's a little, it's called a cage dressing. It's a dressing, but it's a little cage because you don't want them wandering out, freaking out your family.
Right.
You can also, the company sells T-shirts for the clients that say, maggots on board. But I liked that it was interesting to me that one could have these positive feelings about maggots, but if you have this wound that won't heal and you're facing possibly amputation months down the line, and here's something that's going to actually finally help heal this wound, you're pretty okay with maggots.
Right, and it seems like another time that we have this really monolithic institution, the United States military, and these people who are kind of these wild trailblazers doing mm-hmm. something great, and there is, again, some resistance to that. Has the attitude towards the friendly maggot changed?
There was a study about attitudes toward maggot therapy, and there was an assumption on the part of the people doing the research that there would be resistance, that people would be repulsed by, that it would seem anachronistic. But in fact, that wasn't the case. The hesitation, most of the military medical people had heard of maggot therapy, and they thought it would be a good addition to their treatment arsenal. But they didn't know kind of who does it, how do you do it, where do you get them, what's the billing code, you know, all of that. There wasn't a lot of knowledge about it. So they weren't against it. I mean, there have been people on the hospital staff who, it's not just that maggots are kind of gross, it's also that maggots become flies. So you have to, every few days, you got to be really careful because you don't want them, when they're ready to pupate, they crawl out, go somewhere, and then turn into a fly. Now you have flies in a hospital doing that thing that the flies do, going from the bathroom to the food and spreading, you know, hospital bacteria, which can be deadly resistant strains. So that's another reason why it's an uphill battle to get maggot therapy out of the very limited circles that it's in. But there was a guy, George Peck, that I interviewed at Walter Reed, who was he and his wife had me over to dinner, and we had this meal, and then he came out with this little cut glass bowls that looked like chocolate pudding, and he set this down, and it was actually raw liver with hundreds of 2-day-old maggots. But You know, but he had so much reverence for them, and talking about how, you know, a surgeon cannot get into nooks and crannies the way the mandibles of these little tiny creatures can. And it's just he just had this love for the maggot, this remarkable creature, and it was very infectious. And he goes, "Do you want to hold one?" And I said, "Sure." And he took this, and really on their own, it's like a cupcake sprinkle. It's a little couple millimeters, and just on your finger, kind of like, you know, inches long. It's kind of cute on its own, not in a wound, kind of decomposing corpse setting.
This subject matter is, again, no pun intended, deadly serious, but there's a wonderful absurdity to a lot. And I like that the military kind of functions like any large company, that they can do billion-dollar studies and do this, and then one guy at the top will just... You know, the Army wore berets for a while just because one of the generals liked them, and then all the soldiers hated them, and they went back. It seems like you uncover that a lot.
Some of that, yeah. Some of that. Well, yeah, the berets were... Yeah, they were loathed because, you know, for the past two conflicts, we've been in a very hot place. A wool black beret that doesn't shield you from the sun is really not the best headgear to have. Somebody liked them, and so there they were. And it took about 10 years, and finally the Army has its caps back on. They're a little lightweight. You can stick them in a pocket, shield you from the sun.
They actually keep the sun out of your eyes.
The sun out, right. But, you know, the berets, I guess they had a certain jaunty look, a little paratrooper kind of, G.I. Right. Joe, sort of.
I think, I'm sure a lot of people here are like me, have read your other work, and people who've read this, I'm sure they've seen flashes of your other work show up, you know, Packing for Mars, Stiff, these types of, I hear some woos out there. It seems like your books taken together, you know, I'm always sort of resistant to taking someone's, you know, collected body of work and
oeuvre.
Saying oeuvre. Yeah, no, we don't say that.
I'm resistant to just saying oeuvre.
I know,
in general.
I was thinking it, and I was like, nah. but trying to come up with that, these books seem to be about how we thrive, how we overcome things, how we live with each other, how we see, you know, beauty in the common maggot. What draws you to this subject? What draws you to that kind of stuff?
Well, I think just what you said, there are things that on first glance, your reaction is revulsion, dismissal. You don't want to really think about it. But if somebody like me kind of drags you into it a little bit, you realize it's not just gross. It's actually really interesting. And because people tend to look away, there's not a lot written about these things. So it's a topic that's kind of, I mean, I'm kind of the bottom feeder. It's like, oh, I'll take that. I'll do the maggots. You do the other. So I'll take those. But then when you start to dig into the, if you realize it's so interesting and sometimes really important. It's not just gross or silly. That, you know, that's fine too. It can be maybe gross and silly. There's nothing wrong with gross and silly. I make my bread and butter on gross and silly. But it's also really interesting and sometimes life or death.
Right.
Even.
I love that you call yourself the goober with the flashlight shining it in dark corners. That's so great. So my last question before we get to all of your wonderful questions. The last section of the book, it takes place in Dover.
Yes.
And it's in a military morgue, and it's, you know, our fallen warriors coming back. And, you know, it really drives a lot home. That's in the book, at least for me. And... you know, you say the autopsy photographers need to get up high to get the whole body in frame. I guess war is like that. 1,000 points of light, as they say. Only when you step back and view the sum, only then are you able to grasp the worth, the justification for the extinguishing of any single point. Right at the moment, it's tough to get that perspective. It's tough to imagine a step ladder high enough. And while it's tough to imagine that, I guess ultimately now that you've stepped back a little bit, now that... you've maybe received feedback from veterans, the military, et cetera. What's our takeaway? What are we to understand about the science of us at war?
I guess the thing that I took away from it, I came to the book with a sense of the military as this monolithic entity, but it is really so many different populations and people and types of people in different pursuits. And, you know, the people that I spoke to, the people that do this work, were really pretty great, and often their work just kind of falls through the cracks. So, ultimately, I just want people to learn something and have fun. But if in the end they take away some respect for that kind of overlooked world, I think that would be great, because it's hard for those folks, and they do good stuff.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And let's give it up. Okay, so we have some note cards with your questions on them. The first question is, some soldiers describe battles playing out in slow motion to cope with the situation. Is there any truth to that?
Having heard a description of what it was like after a bomb went off, the person we talked about earlier, it did sound like, you know, the times kind of slowed, just flying through the air and having an awareness of what was happening, and it all seeming to take much longer than it really did. That's the only real, I mean, it's anecdotal. I don't know anything about how the neuroscience of it, but
right.
It would seem like probably that does happen.
Right.
Yeah.
I've heard various writers on medicine talk about the danger of shock from traumatic injury. What exactly is shock?
Well, hemorrhagic shock, the number one combat fatality, which is you have a severed artery and you can bleed out, lose so much of your blood that there isn't enough there to keep you alive. And there's different types of shock, but anyway, hemorrhagic shock is bleeding out, and it can happen in a couple of minutes. So it's very important to get a tourniquet on. I mean, some guys would describe driving in convoys with the tourniquet on but not tightened, just in case an ID went off. Kind of intense, yeah. But.
Wow. Well, you talk about how they practice their techniques for, you know, cutting off arteries on pigs. Is that correct?
There's a technique called live tissue training, and it dates back to the Vietnam War, where an anesthetized animal sometimes used to practice that kind of emergency medical care, or a collapsed lung or something. But obviously, it's not popular with the animal rights groups, and there are much better versions now of patient simulators where you can actually have a person put on, it's called a cut suit, and it bleeds, and it can have a collapsed lung. You can eviscerate it. It even smells horrible. Hello, Pam. there's more and more use of these, and there's a bill that I believe was passed that would limit the number of animals. It would, cut that number down. So, yeah.
There's a question I love. It's what really goes on at Monell. It sounds like it's Willy Wonka's chocolate factory
what
or something.
What really goes on at Monell?
Have you considered writing a book covering underwater experiences and climate change? I guess those are two.
And or climate change. Climate change I would leave to Elizabeth Colbert and many other people who are so immersed in it and have such a good the background for it. And underwater, I would consider that, but I'm not a good swimmer/diver. Sue Casey is someone who writes about the ocean. She's written about waves, sharks, dolphins, and she just lives in the water. She was raised in the water. She lives in Hawaii, and I think I'm not enough of an underwater person to do that book.
Right.
But they're both good topics.
Despite spending, 2 days in a nuclear
Well, you put
submarine.
A submarine
yes.
around me, okay. Right. Yeah. Anybody can do that.
I saw it in one of the other cards beforehand, and I'm sure you get this a lot. What is your next book? I heard people even saying it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm open to suggestions. I am open to suggestions.
Do you get people giving you one word, like, titles for everything all the time?
Yes, I do. I do. And of course, you want me to come up with some off the top
no,
of my
no,
head.
No,
people
no.
do. Yeah, no, they do. Uh-huh. You should do a history of the ballpoint pen and call it click. You should do. They're like, there's... Yes, all the time.
Right.
People get that.
Okay, here we go. And this could be saying something. What's the grossest thing you have ever left out of a book?
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? If it's gross, I don't leave it out. I put it in. I have a very tolerant editor as well. I keep thinking she'll just, this is over the top, she'll take it out. But
by the way, we forgot to address.
Yes, this item.
Yes.
Okay, this is, because this is a special giveaway for anybody who buys a copy of the book. This is an actual MRE combat ration toilet paper. It's enough for one poop. Sometimes not enough for one. They are hoarded. They're a very popular item. This is the actual. These are made at Lighthouse for the Blind in San Leandro, California, near where I live. And I ordered a box, and I got stickers that say "grunt," which I thought was kind of appropriate. The whole juvenile double entendre really worked. So I have a big bag of these, and I will be happy. And they're great for backpacking, camping, diarrhea. So there you go. That's the little enticement.
We've set a precedent now for giveaways. Let's see. I think this person means out of your whole oeuvre. What topic have you found people were least willing to talk about?
Oh, least willing to talk about. Well, I tend to choose topic. Well, the thing is, when you go and you speak to somebody who is a researcher in this area, like, for example, in Gulp, there was this woman, this beautiful Italian woman who studied saliva, and you'd think, well, who really wants to be on the record as the saliva lady? But she knows so much about it and how amazing a substance it actually is. You couldn't shut her up. We talked about saliva for hours, and I love that. So I'm usually not trying to pull stuff out of people. It's all usually people are so delighted that someone's taken an interest in this sort of esoteric thing that they do, whether it's maggots or saliva or what have you.
Yeah, I think it's the flashlight thing you talk about. It's places flashlights aren't.
Yeah, I
normally...
know. I was saying I'm not really. You know, I'm not a big issues gal. I'm not like the spotlight is on other stuff, and I want the stuff that somebody forgot that's over in the corner.
I think this is interesting. And I think I know what this question is asking, but if it's not, I'm going to change it to mine anyhow. Do you think you can lead a normal life after being a grunt? And I guess I would add to that, how is particularly military science helping bring the veteran back home, you know, mentally as well as physically?
I think that's an area. I mean, I didn't cover PTSD and emotional issues, only because I tend to be more the human body and all its physicality. I think there's a tremendous amount of difference just in different people's resilience and also what they were exposed to and what the particular benefits and offerings of the local VA are. So that's a question I can't answer.
Okay.
In any kind of expert way.
I have a couple little speed round questions, and they're things people are getting at here too. What's the favorite? What's the best survival tip that you've learned? Perhaps not even something that could apply to our lives.
All right. Here's some survival tips. Okay, if you are lost at sea and it's hot, and you don't have a lot of water, and you're losing precious bodily fluids, you can conserve up to 70% more of them by keeping your shirt wet. Just keep dipping it in the water, keep it cold and wet. I thought that was figured out by this guy there were a couple of volunteers who went in, sat in rafts off of pretended to be adrift at sea, actually off the pier in Elgin's Bay or somewhere in Florida, and they tried different things, like shade helped a lot, keeping your shirt wet helped a lot. Also, if you're escaping from a submarine and you don't have a survival suit or anything and you've held your breath, exhale as you go up. That's very important. Don't hold your breath.
Right. Remember that.
Yeah. Just in general in life, don't hold your breath.
Right. Sharks. What's our best defense against the shark?
You know, it depends on the shark, but in general, sharks are really not... The shark doesn't want a difficult. It wants to have an easy time of it. It's going to go after an injured or a dead fish rather than a live one. It really doesn't particularly want a large mammal, so it's really rare. I mean, great whites are on a category unto themselves, but most of the shark encounters were, you know, were gray or lemon, or they're smaller sharks, but they're sharks. They're still sharks, but there was a tremendous amount of fear in World War II and almost no cases of aviators in the water being attacked or killed. I think in 2,500... because the shark attack file keeps track of all this. In 2,500 accounts of aviators who ended up in the water, 12 were injured or killed. So it's you know, it's not particularly common. And when they come over to the raft, which they do, they're actually doing that because the shade of the raft, there's a little fish underneath the raft that like the shade, and the sharks come to grab the fish underneath. It's unnerving to have the thing, the fin come toward you. But the guys in the rafts was like, they figured out, oh, this is what they're after. They're not after us. You know?
Right. Yeah. I was really cheering for the rat when they did the experiments. And the rat kicks the shark in the nose and the shark.
Yeah, right. Yeah, at one point, they did some fascinating work. The Navy did all this work on sharks. First, the shark repellent stuff, but then looking into, well, what attracts them and what doesn't attract them. Like, if there's no such thing as a shark repellent, and there really isn't a good thing, because it's going to get diluted anyway, and different sharks have different sensibility. So, like, let's just not attract them in the first place. But one of the what's the thing that drives them wild is distressed grouper. Like they took grouper and they like stressed out a fish, and then the sharks were like, this is a fish in peril. This is going to be an easy target. Or guts or blood of fish, and they took a rat in. The shark's like, not my taste. Sorry. But if you put fish guts on the fur of the rat, then they would come over. So it was a very specific, but it was just tremendous amount of very interesting shark research that went on in the 60s.
They're complicated. I think this was somebody in the front. It's a great question. Next week, I'm entering a cadaver lab for the first time. What advice do you have for a very nervous, and there's a little carrot here, and squeamish physical therapy student who gets to dissect a cadaver for the first time? Who was this? There, okay.
Oh, just, you know what, I think that a large part of squeamishness is fear of the unknown. And once you're there and you see what you're dealing with, I think that the anxiety and the squeamishness will give way to fascination and curiosity. My advice would be just enjoy it, because it's really interesting. I mean, maybe I'm kind of weird.
Just roll with it seems to be the theme of these things. This is a great question, I think. Have you thought about a children's book on science, in some area of science?
Yeah, no, I have. I have thought about that, and there was some contractual issues. I was going to do, someone contacted me about doing a middle school version of STIF, but it was my publishing house doesn't do children's, and they would have had to give the rights over. But interestingly, on occasion, the children's magazine Muse, put out by the Smithsonian, has excerpted chapters of my books, and I said to them, oh, do I need to rewrite it and kind of change the vocabulary and make it simpler? And they go, no, we're good. We're good. Sixth grade, yeah, they're good.
So. I can't wait for the
illustrations. So I kind of do write children's books,
right.
Apparently.
These illustrations that traumatize these children forever. I love this one, too. Has anybody approached you about having sort of your travels, your examinations as a movie?
There have been conversations with various I have a television and film rights person in LA who occasionally brings me in. We have meetings and talk about projects that go nowhere. Yeah, no, there's conversations that go nowhere. Yeah.
Get a trip out of it.
Yeah. The problem is that there are not a lot of movies and TV shows about writers, because most of the time we're sitting in a room at a desk. It's
right.
Not compelling cinema.
Right. The field work, on the other hand,
yes,
is pretty fascinating.
Yes, the field work is interesting, but the people doing it are I'm just doing this. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right.
Again, not that compelling.
And all the work happens, really, at home then after
right.
putting it all together.
Right.
Right. I guess sort of on that note, how would you judge, this question asks, how would you judge the quality of most popular science writing today? And I guess I'd follow that up with who are you reading in science writing?
There's a tremendous amount of really good science writing. I was the editor of Best American Science and Nature Writing a few years back, and that was a wonderful experience, even though this stack of magazine pieces that big shows up and it's daunting. But there just was exposed to amazing writing by authors that I didn't know and have since forgotten the names, but they're all in that collection. There's also some really good blogs, science blogs, and I read a lot of fiction actually. I don't read that much science writing. There's a lot of people on the list that I'd like to read. I'd like to read the Jennifer Ackerman book on birds. Mm-hmm. I'd like to read that. I'd like to read some Jana Levine, that astrophysicist, kind of kick-ass woman, and Maria Konnikova, someone else I'd like to read, that book about con artists. So I have a lot of stuff on the to-read list, yeah.
Right, and this is going to be our last question, this can be a very cool job in that I get to talk to people whose writing I like, and I told my friends, and there were sort of a lot of questions in this regard, and you're such a singular voice in your books and self-referential and that kind of thing. So I think people wonder about you. And this question is, how does writing about sex, cadavers, and war change you as a person?
I don't think it has. I really think I'm kind of just me. I don't think it has.
Well, let's hope you stay you for a very long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jason.
And please join us upstairs for the book signing. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.